If your appliances can't handle the holiday hosting heat, December deal drops at Lowe's makes upgrading easy. Get up to 35% off select major appliances, and rewards members save an additional $40 on the Whirlpool electric range and the over-the-range microwave. Plus, get up to 60% off select ladders so you can deck all the halls. Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 12/10. While supplies last. Selection varies by location. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. See Lowe's.com/terms for details.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is, well, pretty straightforward. We have a stack of sources here detailing a week of, frankly, staggering political instability.
It's a lot to get through.
It is. So we need to distill what really matters. We're going to start with this unprecedented clash between the executive branch and Congress, a clash that openly brought up capital punishment.
Unbelievable.
And then we'll move through some surprising resignations and land on these legal and electoral time bombs that look like they're set to go off by 2026.
Yeah, we're seeing this high-velocity political conflict. But what makes this deep dive so critical, I think, is tracing how these minute-by-minute headlines connect back to deeper, long-term issues.
Like gerrymandering, policy failure.
Exactly. From gerrymandering to the, you know, the looming crisis in healthcare and the national debt, we're here to give you the context that hopefully ties all of this chaos together.
Okay, let's dive right into the first incident, because the seriousness here, it just can't be overstated.
Yeah.
It all started with a video. It was titled, Don't Give Up the Ship.
Right. And this video was put out by 6 Democratic members of Congress, people like Senators Mark Kelly and Alyssa Slotkin, and some House members, too.
Representatives Crow, DeLizio, Goodlander, and Houlihan.
And the key thing about this group, the crucial point, is their identity. Every single one of them is a veteran of the armed forces or has served in the intelligence services.
So their message wasn't for the general public?
Not at all. It was a targeted appeal aimed directly at people currently serving in uniform and in the intelligence community.
So what was the core message? It seemed like it was two things. First, just acknowledging the intense stress these communities are under.
Right. But second, and this is the explosive part, they explicitly said that the threats to the Constitution are now seen as domestic, not just foreign.
And they reminded service members of their oath.
Precisely. Their oath is to the Constitution, not to any one leader or political party. And they really emphasize the legal right and duty to refuse illegal orders.
That closing line from Senator Slotkin, we've got your back, that was basically a public guarantee of protection.
Right.
It was a guarantee of political and legal protection. It was saying, if you feel you're being ordered to do something against the law, we will stand with you.
I mean, that's such an unusual message. It just assumes this level of tension where people in uniform might actually fear getting an illegal order.
Well, the sources noted a really stark example, even if it was hypothetical. An order to open fire on civilian fishing boats without provocation, the Democrats were putting out a direct preemptive warning.
And that warning triggered an incredible reaction from the former president.
Yeah.
Donald Trump went on social media furious, calling the video seditious behavior at the highest level.
He called for them to be arrested, put on trial as traitors to our country.
But it went way beyond just arrest. He followed up with the explicit phrase, seditious behavior punishable by death. I mean, an open threat aimed at sitting members of Congress.
Who are also decorated military veterans. The fallout in Washington was deeply alarming. Speaker Mike Johnson, instead of backing away from that, called the video wildly inappropriate.
But then he agreed with the punishment.
He concurred that death is the proper punishment for sedition. And then you had Senator Lindsey Graham demanding a single example of an illegal order, just totally missing the point that the warning was about the future.
The White House tried to walk it back a bit. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt claimed the Democrats brought the president to responding in this way.
But the damage was done. The danger was real. Representative Slotkin later revealed she was assigned a 247 Capitol Police security detail.
Because the threats were deemed that serious.
Exactly. You have a public call for execution leading to a real-world security detail. But here's the major insight from our sources, the real failure we have to talk about.
The story just vanished.
It disappeared almost instantly. You scan the front pages, CNN, Fox, New York Times, gone within 24 hours.
And you have to ask, this is more than just us being desensitized, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean politically when the system treats calls for executing rivals as just another Thursday?
It represents a fundamental failure of political accountability. When extreme threats that in any other time would dominate the news for weeks are just normalized, It means the system's defenses, the media, institutional condemnation, they're failing. It just raises the baseline of what's acceptable.
Well, that kind of high-velocity conflict, that fragility, it has to take a personal toll. And that seems to be the thread that connects us to our next segment. The surprising number of people leaving Congress this week.
Most notably, the resignation of Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene.
The MTG exit was just stunning, mostly because of her prominence and, well, the reasons she gave. Her letter was long, citing disillusionment with Congress.
But it also mentioned being really concerned about the Epstein files release and crucially worrying that the former president was turning against her.
The timing tells a really sharp story, doesn't it? The price of loyalty.
It absolutely does. I mean, think about it. Greene was aided by the political left for 5 years, and she never seemed to fear for her safety. But she was hated by the MEGA base for about 2 weeks, and suddenly she needs protection and has to end her career.
It really shows you where the immediate danger is in today's politics.
It does. Crossing the opposition party means, you know, institutional attacks. But crossing your own populist base means immediate personal threats, and you don't have the party to protect you. If you're seen as a traitor to the base, you've got nowhere to go.
Some sources were speculating this could be some kind of strategic chess move, you know, stepping back to return later. But the analysis seems pretty skeptical of that.
That's right. The source material suggests she just doesn't have that kind of long-term strategic mind. The calculus is pretty simple. She's now been labeled a traitor by the very base that created her. She has no path back. The political structure just consumed another one of its own.
And we should also mention, you know, the more graceful exit of Representative Nydia Velazquez, stepping down after 16 terms.
Yeah, and she was explicit, saying she wanted to make way for a new generation of leaders.
So this backdrop of people leaving, it leads us right into the huge policy struggles the Republican Party is facing, especially on economics. Let's start with the president's plan for those $2,000 relief checks.
Okay, the plan is to fund them with tariff money, but let's just break down the arithmetic here.
Let's do it. The total cost is estimated at $660 billion. Annual tariff revenue is, what, about a third of that?
Roughly. Around $200 billion. So right from the start, the math is just fundamentally broken.
Yeah, that's not even the only obstacle.
And not even close. First, that tariff money isn't just a slush fund for the executive. Congress has to authorize the spending. Second, and this is critical, powerful Republican senators, Ron Johnson, Rick Scott, Bernie Moreno, they're already firmly against it. They want to pay down the $38 trillion national debt.
Not create a new entitlement.
And third, from an economic view, just dumping $300 billion or more onto consumers, that's almost guaranteed to be inflationary. It would completely undercut the efforts to stabilize the very prices people are complaining about.
The other huge policy crisis is healthcare. Premiums for both ACA and non-ACA plans are apparently set to skyrocket,
which is creating a frantic scramble inside the GOP. And the policy ideas are all over the map. You've got retiring Senator Tom Tillis pushing to eliminate all ACA subsidies,
which is wildly unpopular and would crush rural hospitals.
Exactly. Then you have Senator Rick Scott proposing these Trump freedom accounts, but he's also pushing to eliminate the subsidies that keep the market from collapsing.
So what's the ultimate risk here if they can't agree or if they do get rid of the subsidies?
The core risk is what they call the death spiral. Imagine your insurance premium suddenly jumps by 20 or 30%. Young, healthy people who don't use their insurance much, they'll just drop their plans to save money, which leaves the insurance pool full of older, sicker people who need expensive care. So insurers have to raise premiums even higher to cover the costs, which drives even more healthy people out. It's a vicious cycle that makes insurance unaffordable for everyone who actually needs it.
And the numbers back that up.
They do. The nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation study showed a recent increase of 114% in out-of-pocket premiums. It's just not sustainable.
Okay, so let's move from economic policy to legal chaos. Specifically, the just astonishing collapse of the prosecution against former FBI Director James Comey.
And this all centered on the misconduct of the prosecutor, Lindsey Halligan.
What's so wild here is the audacity of the mistakes.
Yeah.
In court, Halligan admitted she never presented the final two-count indictment to the entire grand jury that indicted Comey.
I mean, can you imagine? There were audible gasps in the courtroom. The DOJ later tried to file this puzzling correction, but the damage was already done.
Wait, just so I have this straight. A prosecutor admitted she got an indictment without the grand jury even seeing the final charges. That's That's profound.
It is. And Magistrate Judge Fitzpatrick followed up with this blistering 25-page order. He called it stunning improprieties.
Let's break down what went wrong. It started with a Fourth Amendment violation.
Right. The Fourth Amendment protects you from unreasonable searches. The violation was complex, but basically, officials seized materials under a warrant way back in 2019, but then they illegally rummaged through them again in 2025, accessing private files way beyond what the original warrant allowed.
So a fishing expedition years later.
Essentially. And then there was the use of privilege information, which is catastrophic for a case.
This is attorney-client privilege.
Mostly, yes. Communications that are legally protected. The prosecution used this unlawfully seized privileged material to secure the indictment. They even had an agent who'd been exposed to it testify before the grand jury. That just taints the entire process.
And then his conduct went right into the grand jury room itself.
Oh, it did. Halligan made severe misrepresentations. She implied Comey had no Fifth Amendment right not to testify, which is just flatly wrong. And even worse, she told the grand jury they could rely on better evidence that would be presented at the actual trial.
But that's not their job.
Exactly. Their job is to assess the evidence in front of them. The judge basically said her law license is now in serious jeopardy. The whole case could be dismissed.
Let's pivot from there to the electoral map, where the courts are also playing this decisive role through gerrymandering.
Right. The Texas case. A district court ruled the Texas map was an illegal racial gerrymander, but Justice Alito temporarily saved it.
He granted an administrative stay.
Which sounds minor, but the consequence was massive. It pushed the final decision past the state's December 8th filing deadline. So by delaying the ruling, he effectively locked in that map for this election cycle, no matter what the final legal decision is.
And the stakes for control of Congress are huge.
Mm-hmm.
If that Texas map survives, it nets Republicans about 3 seats.
Yeah.
If it had been voided, it was a D+2 gain.
But, and this is a big but, you have to consider the blue state counterpunch. States where Democrats control the process, like Virginia and Illinois, they have new maps ready to go.
And the numbers there.
The data shows Virginia could net 3 Democratic seats, Illinois 2. That's a potential D+5 gain. So even with Texas, the whole national gerrymandering fight could end up as a wash or even a small net win for Democrats.
Which sets a really interesting stage for 2026 and brings us to this historical warning, the 6-year itch.
Yeah, history shows the president's party almost always gets hit with severe losses in the Senate during their 6th year in office. We saw it with Eisenhower, Nixon, Ford, Obama. It's a very consistent pattern.
And given the 2026 map, history suggests Democrats are in a good position to pick up seats.
A very good position. The most vulnerable GOP seats are North Carolina and Maine. And if Democrats can get to a 50-50 Senate, which is a high-leverage scenario, it gives enormous power to moderates like Senator Lisa Murkowski.
She could threaten to vote with the Democrats.
And effectively hand the majority leader role back to Chuck Schumer, completely derailing the incumbent's agenda. That 29-point swing among independents in the recent Virginia election, it shows that movement is already happening.
That shifting ground makes the 2028 horizon feel a lot closer. Many in the media are acting like J.D. Vance is the inevitable nominee for Republicans.
But historically, sitting vice presidents really struggle to get the top job. It's only happened twice since 1800.
Why is that?
It's structural. VPs are always seen as an extension of the sitting president, who almost always loses popularity over time. They don't have their own identity, and they can't run as the change candidate because they're part of the system the public wants to change.
And running as Trump III doesn't seem like a winning formula for a general election.
Yeah.
So are we seeing competitors trying to carve out their own space already?
Absolutely. You're seeing these proxy fights develop. Ted Cruz is strategically picking fights over things like NASA and FCC nominees, even attacking people close to Vance. He's working to build an independent brand right now.
And Vance could have competition from a familiar name in 2028. Robert Kennedy Jr. He's relaunching his We the People party.
And that's smart, because getting ballot access is often easier for an actual party than an independent candidate. The party's theme is explicitly non-ideological anti-establishment, which makes it a perfect spoiler.
Because it pulls from both sides.
Exactly. It captures niche voters, anti-vaxxers, people who distrust the deep state from both the far left and the far right. It could be corrosive to both major parties.
But regardless of who's running, it all seems to hinge on one thing, the economy. The latest polls confirm James Carville was right. It's the economy, stupid.
Still true. It's the top issue for a third of Americans. And here's the number that should have the incumbent party very worried. 65% of Americans believe current policies are making their grocery prices go up.
And 77% think the administration isn't spending enough time on it.
It's not a theoretical complaint. It's a visceral kitchen table dissatisfaction, the kind that predicts severe midterm losses.
And that unhappiness with the economy, it directly fuels how people feel about wealth disparity. Polls show Democrats, 75% of them, think billionaires spending money on elections is bad for democracy.
Which creates a clear political opening for Democrats if they ever get a governing trifecta. They could leverage that anger for some significant tax reform.
What are the main proposals?
The sources detail a few. First, removing the $176,000 FICA tax cap. So right now, a billionaire pays the same amount in Social Security tax as someone making just over that threshold. Removing the cap would make high earners contribute a lot more.
And the others target the highest levels of wealth.
Exactly. Second, raising the top income tax rate back towards Eisenhower-era levels, which were as high as 91%. Third, raising the estate tax on estates over $100 million to 95%. And finally, closing loopholes for people who renounce their citizenship to avoid taxes. These are specific fixes based on that public anger.
Wow. So we've covered everything from calls for executing members of Congress to a prosecutor potentially losing their law license, all while the electoral and economic ground just keeps shifting under everyone's feet in Washington.
It's a moment defined by high stakes risk and real systemic instability.
Absolutely.
And if we combine the historical pattern of that 6-year itch with the public's current very real economic pain, where 2/3 of Americans blame current policies for their grocery bills, it raises a big question, a question that goes beyond the scandals we know about.
Right.
Beyond the obvious which economic unknown unknown, you know, maybe a sudden trade war, an unexpected debt crisis, which one is most likely to deliver that decisive, unforeseen blow to the incumbent party in 2026? That is what you need to be watching for next year.